United States certainly seems to believe that the people of Iraq need liberating.
The Iraqi people are very suspicious about the source of their liberation, because the same group of people that have been responsible for their oppression in many ways are now becoming the liberator.
We try by our prayers here, as followers of Jesus, to pray for peace, especially in this region, in the Holy Land.
We will keep making Valentines.
We will keep making Valentines.
Until you adopt. A politics based on compassion.
A politics based on compassion.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, February 14th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Chief UN Weapons Inspectors Hans Blix and Mohamed El-Baradei delivered their critical reports to the UN Security Council today. The wording chosen to characterize their findings in Iraq could launch or stymie the Bush administration's war agenda against Baghdad. Robert Knight from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York has this report.
The session began with reports by arms inspectors Mohamed El-Baradei of the International Atomic Energy Agency and the United Nations' Hans Blix.
Since we arrived in Iraq, we have conducted more than 400 inspections covering more than 300 sites. All inspections were performed without notice, and access was almost always provided promptly. In no case have we been seen convincing evidence that the Iraqi side knew in advance that the inspectors were coming. Through the inspections conducted so far, we have obtained a good knowledge of the industrial and scientific landscape of Iraq, as well as of its missile capability. But as before, we do not know every cave and corner. Although I can understand that it may not be easy for Iraq in all cases to provide the evidence needed, it is not the task of the inspectors to find it. Iraq itself must squarely tackle this task and avoid belittling the questions.
Blix noted improved inspection resources and cooperation with Iraqi officials, but warned that the Samud and Fatah missile systems were problematic because of tests exceeding a mandated 150-kilometer range.
Earlier this week, UNMOVIC missile experts met for 2 days with experts from a number of member states to discuss these items. The experts concluded unanimously that based on the data provided by Iraq, the two declared variants of the Al-Samud 2 missile were capable of exceeding 150 kilometers in range. This missile system is therefore proscribed for Iraq pursuant to Resolution 687 and the monitoring plan adopted by Resolution 715.
Iraq's delegate to the UN said the allegation was confusing in that the measurement was one of a number of random results obtained from missile range testing. Meanwhile, the IAEA's Mohamed El-Baradei said that investigations are continuing in regard to alleged uranium imports and the aluminum tubes that Iraq says were not intended for nuclear fuel enrichment. El-Baradei gave Iraq a clean bill of health on another potential nuclear resource, carbon filaments.
The IAEA inspectors found a number of documents relevant to transactions aimed at the procurement of carbon fiber, a dual-use material used by Iraq in the past clandestine uranium enrichment program for the manufacture of gas centrifuge rotors. Our review of these documents suggests that the carbon fibers sold by Iraq was not intended for enrichment purpose, as the specification of the material appear not to be consistent with those needed for manufacturing rotor tubes. In addition, we have carried out follow-up inspections during which we have been able to observe the use of such carbon fibers in non-nuclear-related applications and to take samples.
The cooperation alluded to by the inspectors was welcomed by Syria's foreign minister.
Mr. Blix and Mr. El-Baradei submitted their reports and noted the progress made in the period that had elapsed since they last submitted their reports to the Council. What this means is that in no more than 2 weeks, substantial progress has been made in the work of the inspectors. The progress reached its peak today when Iraq issued a decree prohibiting weapons of mass destruction there. The progress is a proof that the inspections are bringing about important results given the dialogue, cooperation, and mutual confidence between the inspectors and Iraq. The Council must therefore continue to support the inspectors and allow them sufficient time to undertake their task as prescribed in Resolution 1441.
But Secretary of State General Colin Powell was, as before, not convinced.
I am glad that access has been relatively good. But that is all process. It is not substance. I am pleased to hear that decrees have now been issued that should have been issued years and years ago. But does anybody really think a decree from Saddam Hussein, directed to whom, is going to fundamentally change the situation? And it comes out on a morning when we are moving forward down the path laid out by Resolution 1441. These are all process issues. These are all tricks that are being played on us. Resolution 1441 was not about inspections. Resolution 1441 was about the disarmament of Iraq. We worked on that resolution for 7 weeks. From the time of President Bush's powerful speech here at the United Nations General Assembly on the 12th of September until the resolution was passed on the 8th of November.
The French foreign minister recalled that the Security Council voted for a two-stage process in Resolution 1441, which allows for inspections to mature before the use of force.
France believes two things. First, the option of inspections has not been taken to the end. It can provide an effective response to the imperative of disarming Iraq. Secondly, the use of force would be so fraught with risk for people, for the region, and for international stability, that it should only be envisioned as a last resort.
The French statement was the only one to gain universal agreement in the halls of the Security Council, as indicated by the uncustomary applause at the conclusion of his appeal for United Nations unity.
In this temple of the United Nations, we are the guardians of an ideal, the guardians of a conscience. The onerous responsibility and immense honor we have must lead us to give priority to disarmament through peace. This message comes to you today from an old country, France, from a continent like mine, Europe, that has known war, occupation, barbarity. It is an old country that does not forget and is very aware of all it owes to freedom fighters who came from America and elsewhere. And yet France has always stood upright in the face of history before mankind. Faithful to its values, it wants resolutely to act together with all members of the international community. France believes in our ability to build together a better world. Thank you, Mr. President.
In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Peace Watch.
Several school children from Saginaw, Michigan, have sent very special greetings to President Bush. Today, Tri-City Action for Peace will deliver five giant Valentines for Peace to the White House and to War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's personal residence, as well as other members of Bush's cabinet. Ingrid Drake from WBIX.org, Refugees and Exiles Radio Network, was there and has this report.
Congresspeople looking out the west windows of the Capitol today would have seen five large, colorful messages of peace. Morgan Guyton, who helped deliver the giant cards, explained the goals of the group.
We love what the world can be. We believe it can be that way. We will persist in making it so. That is compassion, the well of goodness in our universe. We have here today five testimonies of faith, hope, and love from the youth of Saginaw, Michigan. From the St. Mary's Cathedral Parish, the St. Andrew's Parish, the St. Joseph's Parish, and the Islamic Center of Saginaw, as well as neighborhood kids from the Cathedral District neighborhood in Saginaw. We will deliver these to our congressmen, our senators, our president, and our Secretary of Defense. These children are our future. They are young enough not to be afflicted by the terrible lust for dominance that has infected our nation.
The cards were more than 10 feet tall and 5 feet across, decorated with paint, magazine cutouts, and small paper outlines of children's hands.
My name is Monique Metcalf. I'm from Saginaw in Michigan, and I'm the Rotary Ambassadorial Scholar for International Understanding and Goodwill. I love this one in particular, the globe with America represented with a heart. Isn't that beautiful? And the message is that as the most powerful nation on earth, it should begin with us. The love should begin with us. And the children wrote, we love the children of Iraq, because children do not understand things like race and different nationalities. They all love each other and accept each other. And hopefully from this message from the children, we can also learn something.
Could you tell us a little bit about the ages of the children?
A wide variety of ages were involved in this. The youngest kid may have been 5, and the oldest people were, 70. One of the parishes is particularly Latino. The Cathedral District neighborhood that did one of our Valentines is mostly African-American. There are a lot of white kids as well. And, of course, the Islamic Center of Saginaw has a lot of children of different ethnic backgrounds who are Muslim in their faith. I should add that that is not a Valentine, but it is an Eid card. Because Eid is the Muslim holiday that celebrates the restraint that Abraham showed on whatever mountain he was on when he was going to sacrifice his son Ishmael to God, and God intervened and said, no, don't kill a child. And so they have their Eid card here to say, don't kill the children of Iraq.
And did the children want to come with you all out here?
No, the children would have loved to have come with us all out here. We barely got out of having 100 children running around on the lawn of the Capitol. But it's a long trip from Saginaw, Michigan, and we had logistical problems bringing these here already, so we thought that 100 children it would have been great though, wouldn't it?
Morgan described the anti-war movement in Saginaw, Michigan.
We have a group called the Tri-City Action for Peace, and I'm the coordinator. We've been organizing pretty heavily. We have 4 vigils a week on different intersections in town. We usually have a big action every month. This was our action of February. January, we had a rally in solidarity with a big march in D.C. We actually had over 100 people come out, which is very significant for Saginaw. Yeah, so, you know, it tends to be a fairly conservative town. The response has been almost universally positive. It's been very heartwarming to see what people, have said in response. Another important thing about Valentine's Day that most people don't know is that St. Valentine was a priest during the reign of Emperor Claudius II of the Holy Roman Empire. Claudius II made a decree that there would be no more marriage because he wanted his men focused on his goal, which was to conquer all of the known world through war. And he thought that marriage was a distraction. St. Valentine persisted in marrying people in secret, and for that he was beheaded. So St. Valentine's Day is, by its origin, an anti-war holiday. This is our country.
This is our country.
We will not let you make it into an empire. We will not let you make it into a police state.
We will not let you make it into a police state.
And we will keep marching.
And we will keep marching.
We will keep making Valentines.
We will keep making Valentines.
And we will keep disrupting business as usual.
And we will keep disrupting business as usual.
Until you adopt.
Until you adopt.
A politics based on compassion.
A policy that's based on compassion.
Rather than dominance.
Rather than dominance.
The group will be in New York City tomorrow for the march, and then will travel 12 hours back to Saginaw. This is Ingrid Drake reporting for WBIX.org, Refugees and Exiles Radio Network.
Several thousand pilgrims from many Christian denominations converged this morning at Jesus' baptism site of Tel Kahar on the Jordanian side of the Jordan River for a period of worship and prayers for peace. Raphael Kraft reports.
Thank, applaud, and pray for the Iraqis who are among us today. Greet the Iraqi people. We are asking God to keep the peace for the Iraqi and Palestinian people and the rest of the world. The
Reverend Haddad, along with representatives of most Christian faith from all around the Middle East, gives a special service to thousands of pilgrims before heading to Jesus' baptism site on the east bank of the Jordan River. In the crowd, Nadia, a 17-year-old Iraqi refugee who arrived in Jordan at the age of 6.
Actually, now we're having this festival for Jesus Christ, that he can help us in our life, for Iraq and Palestine, and for everyone that is not living, and all the poor people, you know. So that if war happens, they can be safe and everything, you know.
The improvised pulpit faces the west bank of the Jordan River. Salim Haddad, a retired Jordanian citizen, describes the scenery.
We are now in the lowest part of the world, the lowest point on earth, the Jordan Valley. If we look to the west side, this is the Palestinian territory, the West Bank, and this is Jericho. Over there it will be behind the hills, there is the Jerusalem. Over there, it will be Bethlehem and the Dead Sea, of course. Behind us, yani, around 3 or 4 kilometers, there will be the Jordan River. There is the border.
The Jordanian army's bagpipes are there, but no banners nor signs related to the current events in the Middle East are displayed in the gathering. But as Father Samir Tota from New York describes, the event speaks for itself.
You know, according to the gospel, John lived in the wilderness. He was preaching, you know, repentance, reconciliation. And Jesus came from Galilee, from Nazareth, you know, to this region to be baptized by John. And from that moment on, Jesus began his mission as preacher, healer, and picked his disciples at that time here. And then he spent 3 years preaching the gospel, the good news of salvation. We try by our prayers here as followers of Jesus to pray for peace, especially in this region, in the Holy Land.
Overlooked by security guards and watchtowers, the pilgrims walk through the canyon of the holy Wadi Harar, surrounded by reeds. The appearance of an Israeli flag is the sign that the River Jordan isn't far. After a one-hour walk, pilgrims hit the barbed wires that forbid access to the Jordan River. There is a little gate guarded by Jordanian soldiers. The crowd begs for their plastic bottles to be filled by the soldiers to confirm their baptism. 50 meters ahead on the west bank of the river, 5 Israeli soldiers smoking cigarettes watch the scene, their legs balancing above the flow of the Holy River. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Raphael Kraft in Wadi Harar.
Let there be peace in my mind. Let there be peace in the earth.
The U.S. bombing campaign over the so-called no-fly zones over Iraqi airspace continued this week. This time it was on the heels of a visit to Baghdad by historian William R. Polk, former State Department official under the Kennedy administration. Upon his return to the States, Polk held an informal press briefing in Washington, D.C., to which Peace Watch producer Reem Khatouda was among the invitees. Here is the second of our two-part report.
Or if the Iraqi government says, we've got basically two things we want to try to do. We want to try to keep the country from being destroyed, and we want to try to keep the government in existence. Then you say, okay, those are the fundamental objectives that you have. Now, what could you possibly do to move toward accomplishing them? You have three possibilities, it seemed to me. One possibility is to say, we're going to run away. And obviously that doesn't accomplish the objective of keeping the place intact. And he said, I was born in Baghdad. I'm going to die in Baghdad. I'm not going away. I was at the frontier twice for fairly extensive times, which you have to be to get cleared through. And I didn't find anybody leaving or anybody going out. I talked to two companies that handle cars going in and out. Nobody was packed on buses or trucks or anything leaving. The second possibility of trying to stave things off was just to stay as they are. And I said, if you stay as you are, it seems to me you're all going to get killed. And that's obviously not a wonderful approach to accomplishing your objectives. And the third possibility is to get up and take a forward position, an aggressive position, and say, we are really going to go 150% to cooperate with the UN inspectors, and we're going to do everything we possibly can to prove that we don't have any weapons of mass destruction. And Tariq Aziz interrupted me, and he said, you know, I've studied logic, and in logic, you cannot prove a negative. We cannot prove that we don't have any weapons of mass destruction. And I said, okay, well then let's try to figure out what you can do that would make some move in that direction. One possibility was to say, let's institutionalize the inspectorate program on the analogy of the UN peacekeeping force and say, let's have it here for 5 years. Let's have 1,000 or 2,000 or however many thousand inspectors anybody wants to have, and you pay for them. And he said, I think we can do that. And then I said, secondly, you've got to create a new image of yourselves in the world. And one thing that occurs to me that you might offer to do is to say, as soon as you get your oil industry back in operation, you're willing to devote 5% of your revenue from it to international peace or international health programs through the United Nations. And he said, well, I think that's a good idea. We could do that too. And then the third thing is that you all enter into an international treaty which would specify that you're not going to ever again try to acquire weapons of mass destruction. And he said, well, you know, obviously we're at a position that that probably makes sense. So I think these are the critical things that they can do at this point, but I'm afraid that it isn't going to make any difference. I think the thing is all decided, and he said, you know, we are pretty sure that it's not going to make any difference. My friend Peter Jennings was there a short time before, and he said, I talked to him and told him about this, and he didn't say anything at all about it when he reported on his trip to Baghdad. He said, nobody tells what we tell them about what we're doing, and they all report things that, like Blix's report to the United Nations, he said his arms were practically twisted off to make him say things that you all wanted him to say. And you are telling everybody, all the governments, to do things, but we know that the world's people are really not in favor of what you're trying to do. And I thought, what are the two alternatives? One alternative before us is war. And if we go in, and if, as some people hope and think, we're going to find that 99% of the people in Iraq are out waving American flags and are absolutely delighted that we've come and are all in favor of us and so forth, that still leaves 60,000 people in Baghdad who are going to hate our guts. And if you really wanted to do Osama bin Laden's work, what could we possibly do any better than what we're going to do? There's an old 19th century European literary analogy to the problem we have about the creation of Dr. Frankenstein, of his monster. The problem with the monster that Frankenstein created was that he had his own agenda, and it was not the agenda of Dr. Frankenstein. And we created the forces to fight against Saudi Arabia by providing enormous amounts of money, hundreds and hundreds of tons of hundreds of thousands of tons of weapons and so forth to go into Afghanistan. And then the monster turned on us. This is the problem. We as Americans don't look very far ahead. We think right today Mr. X is opposed to Mr. Y, and I don't like Mr. Y, so Mr. X is a Democrat. He's a great fellow, and he's on our side, and he's wonderful. And then all of a sudden Mr. X does something we don't like, and then it's Mr. X who's our enemy, and we have to go on to the next situation. And the problem that we've got, it seems to me, about Iraq is a humanitarian problem. We're going to kill thousands and thousands of people needlessly. B, a policy problem, which is that nothing that we could do would hurt our position in the world any more than what we're about to do. If Osama bin Laden were the chief of policy planning in the government, this is what he'd recommend that we do. And the third thing is, selfishly, as an American, I'm very worried that what we're going to do is going to destroy many of the things that I think are enormously valuable in our society. It's going to hurt our legal system, our sense of civil rights, our trust of one another, what we all like to believe that we can live with, and so forth. And this is a horrible, horrible situation. Conceivably, if we were absolutely at the last extremity and the only way to save our lives was to do something like this, we could argue that there is a rationale behind it. But what kind of threat does Iraq pose to America? It's a tiny little country, 23 or 24 million people. The army is antiquated. Its equipment is like the Baghdad taxi force, everything pieced together from scraps and pieces of other things. No possible delivery system. It's broke. They can't buy anything to replace anything. They have a small army. They're surrounded by powerful enemies. Iran has an army two or three times as large. Turkey has a world-class army much larger. Israel has one of the strongest armies in the world with 600 nuclear weapons. Where's the danger? What are we so desperately trying to protect ourselves from? A story came out just before I went to Iraq that we have teams of people already in Iraq who were empowered, like a James Bond figure, to assassinate him on site, and who were tapping the telephones to try to find out where he is in order to go in and assassinate him. And as you know, our government has come out with remark after remark that that a bullet's cheaper than a tank and various other things like that. Regime change simply means, is a euphemism for murder. And this, to me, is terribly disturbing, too. I find, having most of my life thought of myself as a liberal Democrat, I find I'm an extremely conservative, old-fashioned American. I happen to believe in legality, and I think these we're playing fast and loose with the things that are absolutely fundamental to our way of life. Right now, for example, I know that the aid administration is putting out contracts for the rebuilding of Iraq as of last week, in the multi-billion dollar range. And so the decision has obviously been made to go ahead in this. We had this marvelous reservoir of goodwill, and the reservoir is now well drained in many parts of the world. And this is a frightening, difficult thing. I don't think that one is a patriotic American to be quiet about these things. I think one is a patriotic American to stand up and say, this is crazy. This is really very, very dangerous. This is destroying what our country has grown up with and lived with and has protected it. And God damn it, I'm very patriotic.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Kathuda.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.